Political chaos in Libya. Today, Thursday, October 10th. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. The head of Libya's government was seized by militias in his nightshirt and then released a few hours later. A veteran Mideast correspondent says it's a terrible sign.
The impact of kidnapping a Libyan citizen in the streets of Tripoli, it's a huge setback for democracy in that country.
Also today, reaction to Canada's Alice Munro winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. Her fellow writers are definitely cheering the decision.
Yay! Fantastic. Three cheers, jumping up and down, sending emails, making phone calls.
We'll hear why novelist and fellow Canadian Claire Massoud likes Munro's story so much. Plus, a sports legend from India says he's putting down his cricket bat.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. The U.S. helped topple the dictatorship of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. That was 2 years ago. Well, today we got a reminder of just how far Libya still has to go. The head of the country's fragile government, Prime Minister Ali Zeidan, was seized at gunpoint by an armed militia. Other officials called it a kidnapping, right in the heart of the capital, Tripoli. After a few hours, he was released and spoke to the Libyan people. Prime Minister Zeidan thanked those who helped release him, and he called for calm. Abigail Hauslohner is covering the story for The Washington Post from Cairo. Abigail, this is still pretty confusing. Tell us what you know about what actually happened to Prime Minister Zeidan this morning in Tripoli.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm still struggling to understand what's going on in Tripoli. In fact, a lot of the Libyans I've talked to are also struggling to understand what exactly happened. What we do know is that the prime minister was taken from his hotel room by gunmen, and he was held for about 6 hours before he was released unharmed. Now, the group that initially claimed to be holding him is a militia that is tasked with protecting the General National Congress. That's essentially Libya's elected parliament. The militia then later denied that. They denied that they had any role, although it seems quite likely that the militia did play a role, although we don't know why exactly. And Zeidan said after his release that he was grateful, as you mentioned, to the militias and the police and the army and the people who had helped secure his release, but he didn't say who captured him or why. So that's left a lot of questions.
There were early reports that the abduction and release had some connection to do with the U.S. seizure of the al-Qaeda suspect last weekend, Abu Anas al-Libi. What's the latest on the link between those two?
Well, we know that a lot of people were very angry at Zeidan. Zeidan has a lot of enemies in Libya, and we know that certainly criticism surged in the past week after the American capture of this al-Qaeda suspect. So that's certainly... it's certainly a possibility. It's something that people are speculating. And the group that captured him, one spokesman for the group seemed to allude to the notion that perhaps Zeidan was captured because of their frustration with the Libyan government sort of being in compliance with the U.S. raid. But it's very murky. It's very unclear.
So this incident conveys to the rest of the world, at least, a rather graphic image of real insecurity in Libya. Is that a fair description?
Oh, absolutely. Libya is essentially still lawless. It's been completely lawless since the overthrow of Gaddafi, and you have a lot of weapons flowing around and a lot of essentially revolutionaries, men who fought against Gaddafi and these different sort of disparate rebel units who are now still holding on to their guns and wielding power and competing in this very lawless society to have their voices heard.
What have you heard from your Libyan contacts in terms of their reaction to this incident this morning?
Well, there's a lot of confusion and also frustration. I mean, a lot of ordinary Libyans have been voicing their frustration with the continued power of these militias for quite a while. We've seen protests in Benghazi after U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens was killed there. We saw protests against the power of militias, Libyans coming out and saying, you know, we're tired of this. We're tired of militias being able to sort of push people around and, you know, carry out a brazen attack on the U.S. embassy or kidnap politicians. We want the government to do something about it. And the government, or, you know, government officials, members of the Congress have said that they are trying and that they do genuinely want to disarm the militias. What the government has done is basically try to bring a lot of those militias under their wing, essentially put them on government payroll in order to try to get them under their authority. And that's how you end up with situations like today where, you know, the militia that kidnapped Zaydan is also is rumored to be a militia that is effectively under the Interior Ministry. But it's obviously these methods aren't working. They're not really reining in the militias.
Abigail Hausloner is Cairo Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thanks, Abigail.
My pleasure.
The erosion of central authority isn't unique to Libya. Our next guest thinks it's a hallmark of the new Middle East.
For a long time in the Middle East, our problem was the central authority, the dictators. I think we've reached a point now where even a prime minister of a country, even as shaky as Libya, cannot protect himself.
That's Iraqi journalist Gaith Abdul Ahad, a correspondent for The Guardian. He says these days it's hard for anyone in Libya to do their job.
How can a journalist or an official or a human rights worker try to reveal the facts of what's going on the ground if a prime minister is abducted? This is on one side. On the other side, I mean, it has to do with the abduction of Abu Anas al-Libi, the Qaeda suspect who was kidnapped by the Americans. Now, yes, Abu Anas should be put on trial, but the impact, the direct impact of kidnapping a Libyan citizen in the streets of Tripoli, you see it 2 days later, and it's a huge setback for democracy in that country.
What has to happen to make it less of a kind of Wild West?
Unless the people themselves, the people who are the militia commanders, the warlords, and it's not only Libya, by the way. I mean, I've seen it everywhere from Libya now to Iraq, this emergence, the new emergence of this cult of the warlords, something really coming from the Middle Ages at the moment. Unless the people realize that they don't need those people, and unless the tribes themselves decide to disarm the militias and give faith into a national government, I don't think there'll be much change. Again, you have to remember something. For us, since the 50s, the nation state has been always associated with the dictator, with the guy with the thick mustache, his family, his clan in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria. The moment that symbol, the moment that dictator is toppled, we are back into square number one. We are questioning, actually, the concept of a nation state. We're questioning what is Iraq, what is Libya, what is Syria. It's a very interesting debate, but it's a very dangerous debate at the same time. It's happening with guns.
Significantly, you mentioned this was happening across the Middle East in various places you traveled, and you mentioned Syria, where I know you traveled in September. How has the narrative there changed in recent months?
We are moving into a situation which I seriously cannot see or predict what will happen in Syria in the next 6 months. Many of the commanders I've known, many of the revolutionaries who've been kind of fighting the regime for the past 2 years, kind of are questioning their priorities at the moment. They tell you, I don't want Bashar to be toppled now, otherwise we'll be fighting each other. We need to find some unity, and then we go back against the regime. I know commanders who have fled the fighting because of the infighting between themselves and the problems with the jihadis. The jihadis who seem to kind of basically sometimes perceived as attacking the rebels from behind while the rebels are engaged fighting the government in the front. All these different elements is creating something in Syria which is beyond. I mean, if you compare Syria to Libya, Libya is a Geneva now compared to Syria.
Now, in Syria, you visited the countryside of the southwest part of that country. Who did you meet with there? What did you see?
I went with some commanders. We were in the countryside of Hama province. And, you know, we spend days traveling along kind of dirt roads, along stone hills. You reach a point when the rebels are attacking. The reality is they don't see the commanders I was with, they don't see a purpose for that battle. They achieve a victory, but they don't know if that victory will be utilized in a better way or in a worse way. And that, in a sense, it kind of tells you the whole debate. There is no like one battle that they can go through and win and achieve a change. One of the commanders was telling me, he says, in the beginning, we thought if we go demonstrating against the regime, we'll topple the regime. Then we thought like we'll have to do something with hunting rifles and Kalashnikovs. Then we thought, like, once we have artillery pieces and anti-aircraft rockets, we will achieve something. Now they have the rockets, they have the artillery, they have tanks with them, but it's kind of tiny little squares of wars happening all over the country without a bigger comprehensive picture.
Iraqi journalist Geith Abdul Ahad is a correspondent for The Guardian. He recently returned from Syria. Thanks, Geith.
Thank you.
The world of cricket woke up to shocking news this morning. That should be your cue to stop listening, right? Well, hold on. One of cricket's biggest stars, Sachin Tendulkar of India, announced he's retiring this year. For cricket, it's like LeBron James calling it quits. Tendulkar has set numerous records over the years, but as the world's Bradley Campbell reports, he means much more than that to his country and his fans.
My introduction to Sachin Tendulkar came in 2002. I was living in Trinidad, studying at the University of the West Indies. Now, India was scheduled to play the West Indies in cricket. That's all anyone seemed to talk about. Really, it was less about the match, though, than it was about the arrival of a batsman, Sachin Tendulkar. It was like the arrival of the Babe Ruth of cricket. Now, the Caribbean is crazy about the sport, and newspapers covered his every swing. The guy seemed bigger than the game itself.
This guy is like the god of cricket in India.
That's the world's Manya Gupta. She grew up in Lucknow.
He started playing at the age of 16 professionally for the country. And then for the past 25 years, he's been playing and he's been creating all sorts of records on the field. And he is like the guy that people think of when they think of cricket in India or probably in the subcontinent.
She says the surprising part about Tendulkar is that he doesn't act like this prima donna. Now, that's something when you consider his star power is like Tom Brady and Brad Pitt rolled into one.
He has been a sort of brand ambassador, not only for the sport, but for the country because of his record on the field and his character off the field. And he is sort of a non-controversial figure in a country like India where almost everything else is controversial.
He comes across as a very, very down-to-earth, unassuming kind of a guy.
The freelance writer Asim Chabra says that personality, it allowed Tendulkar to reach audiences beyond the cricket world, people who don't know a wicket from a crease.
But Sachin took Indian cricket to a very different level. He started getting all these brand endorsements, brands like Coca-Cola and Adidas and Toshiba.
I reached Chabra in New Delhi, and like most cricket fans, he has a Tendulkar moment. It came last year when the batsman became the first player to score 100 runs for the 100th time in international play. Now, it's okay if you don't understand the significance. Just know that that feat is incredible.
It was really very moving. Everybody cheered and, you know, he raised his bat and you could see he was very emotional. I mean, at the end of the day, he's a sportsman and a terrific sportsman. And so he raised his bat sort of acknowledging the cheering. And it was really terrific.
Such moments are coming to a close, though. Tendulkar is 40 years old. Chabra says it's time for the great athlete to finally put down his bat.
It was time for him to retire, really. But people are still very shocked. People are still, it's an end of an era as such. It's a very dramatic end of an era.
Tendulkar's final appearance will be in India, and tickets will be at a premium. It will be his 200th international test match. And after that, he'll call it a day. Deepak Singh, a contributor to The World, grew up idolizing the athlete. And he says the great batsman of Mumbai will walk away a legend.
He's the god of cricket, will always be. And he's retiring soon, and this makes me sad. Cricket will never be the same for me.
For The World, I'm Bradley Campbell.
And you can find more of Deepak Singh's thoughts on his retiring cricket hero at PRI.org. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The specter of an unprecedented U.S. debt default might be just the thing that gets Washington moving again, eventually. We'll see. But I'm sure everyone in D.C. agrees we don't want to end up like Argentina. The South American nation defaulted on its debt a little over a decade ago. So could that default offer any lessons for us now? The World's Jason Margolis looked into that.
Argentina's default in 2001 was the final straw in a long economic crisis. The country already had rampant inflation and people were losing faith in the Argentine currency. Then came the default and Argentina's entire financial system fell apart. Alberto Ferreras, a surgeon in Buenos Aires, recalls trying to pay a modest sum to Purdue University to reserve his son's spot in college.
All the bank accounts were frozen. I was not able, not even to withdraw the money, but to wire transfer the money. So a good friend of mine sent the money to the U.S. on my name, on my behalf.
Eventually, Ferreras was able to withdraw his savings, which were in U.S. dollars. But he was paid back in Argentine pesos, pesos that were severely devalued.
That means that you were going to receive less than 25% of the money you were expected to receive.
That was the pain within Argentina. Economist Desmond Lachman with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington describes the punishment doled out by the rest of the world.
Argentina has basically been shut out of international capital markets for the last 11 years.
In other words, defaulting on your debt is a bad, 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 bad idea. But wait.
That wouldn't be the case in the United States.
Lachman says he doesn't want to minimize the impact of a default here in the U.S. It would be a reputational hit and likely raise the interest rate for our borrowing going forward. But people would still loan us money. The two cases are also different because when Argentina defaulted, most of the world didn't really care all that much. Sure, foreign holders of Argentine bonds were angry, and still are today, but the Argentine default didn't send shockwaves across the globe. Lachman says if the U.S. were to default,
we know that this could be hugely disruptive for money markets, for bond markets, for stock markets. This would be a global event.
And here's one more big difference between the U.S. and Argentina.
One's got to distinguish between ability to pay and willingness to pay. And back in 2001, Argentina didn't have the ability to pay. That is not the case in the United States. The case in the United States is one of political dysfunction that people abroad find really very difficult to comprehend.
Put Argentine surgeon Alberto Ferreras on that list.
My friends in America say that they are undergoing a crisis. They don't have the slightest clue of what the crisis is.
Ferreras says he can't believe that U.S. politicians would actually default on America's debt. He says that's a move for underdeveloped countries like Argentina. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Manhattan's East Village has a storied literary past. Luminaries like W.H. Auden, Frank O'Hara, and Allen Ginsberg once lived there. And it's easy to imagine them holding forth deep into the night at one of the dimly lit watering holes that still dot the village. On a recent Sunday, though, there was a different sort of bookish chatter in the neighborhood. This group had gathered to celebrate the literary traditions of Indonesia, specifically the traditions of five of that country's nearly 800 languages. It was part of an effort by a group called the Endangered Language Alliance to shine light on the literature of disappearing languages. The most endangered of the five Indonesian languages highlighted at the event was Tontamboan. Today it's spoken by just about 100,000 people. And like most disappearing languages, it's not being passed down to younger generations. Bruce Wallace has the story.
The tale of Lumimu'ut and Towar is, like a lot of creation myths, a strange one. It involves a crow and a perspiring stone, a couple handfuls of dirt magically turning into an island, and two main characters that are part Adam and Eve and part Oedipus. Rosamund Nincha recites the story in Tontamboan, her native language.
Our parents, they speak Tontamboan, but in the school, I didn't learn Tontamboan. In the school, Indonesian language.
Munincha says her Tontamboan-speaking parents actually encouraged her to learn Bahasa Indonesia, the country's national language. Her parents thought it was key to their kids getting a better education than they had. She and her husband both left the 1,000-person village they grew up in, moving first to a provincial capital, then to Jakarta. In the mid-90s, they moved to Queens, an immigrant-rich borough in New York City. They both still understand Tontonboan, but their speaking is a little rusty. The stories they've been asked to read by the Endangered Language Alliance are actually not known today among native speakers. They've been gathering dust in a study put together 100 years ago by a Dutch missionary.
Many of the missionaries had a real authentic interest in the religious beliefs and the spiritual life of the people that they were trying to convert. And ironically, now our only window into that world is through their work.
Daniel Kaufman is a specialist in Indonesian languages and founder of the Endangered Language Alliance. The Dutch study collected tons of information about the Tontonboan language, but since it's written in Dutch, it's been inaccessible to Tontonboan speakers. Kaufman thinks it's high time that linguists start restoring this kind of knowledge to people who still speak these languages.
Many, many people feel that knowledge and history and culture has been taken from them by Western academics and never been returned.
It's particularly fitting that the Munitjes are performing these stories, since the Dutch missionary originally recorded them in the same small village where Rose and her husband were born. Reading through the Tontonboan story and getting ready to perform it on stage brought back strong memories of that village for Rose.
When I'm reading this, I just feel like so close, like I'm there. I'm here, but I'm over there. I'm in my village. I just almost cry because I can, oh my gosh, my dad is passed away already 3 years ago. I just remember him all the time when I hear that because in my ear, he's always calling me, oh, Rose, kumano ko, mayo o, Tontonboan stuff. I love that.
Rose and her husband get together regularly to speak in Tontonboan with other expats in the area, trying to keep the language and memories alive. And they were pleased to discover that their daughter had managed to pick up some. Rose's parents spent a lot of time with him when their daughter was first born. A few years later, her daughter noticed Rose's leg bothering her.
My mom always, her leg is pain, and my dad always says, oh, sumakit kay Jayko. That means your leg is painful. You cannot walk. And my daughter say that to me. Oh, you're going to be sumakit kece, mama. I say, what? And then she say, oh my gosh, she knows that.
Rose said she even bragged on Facebook about performing Tontonboan in New York City. And she got props from her daughter, now 12 years old, after the performance.
She loved that. She said, mommy, you're doing good. Mommy, nice. I'm so happy.
Rose thanked her daughter, although she didn't say it in Tontonboan. She said it in Indonesian, which her daughter understands better. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, New York City.
We have more on this story and the Endangered Language Alliance in our podcast, The World in Words. That's at pri.org/language. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, the complicated fictional characters of brand new Nobel laureate Alice Munro.
They are not easily likable. They are not sort of cuddly and lovable. They're people with highly idiosyncratic psyches and strange behaviors and unpleasant longings. She's completely unafraid, and that's part of her genius.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. She's been called the Canadian Chekhov.
I was going to come dressed as Chekhov, but I didn't think it was a good idea.
That was Alice Munro at a reading a few years ago. This morning, she was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. She's the 13th woman to win the award in 112 years. We have Claire Massoud to speak with us. She's a Canadian-American writer. Her latest novel is The Woman Upstairs. So, Claire, what's your reaction this morning when you heard Alice Munro wins the Nobel Prize?
Yay! Fantastic. Three cheers, jumping up and down, sending emails, making phone calls.
So why? What is it about her that made you thrilled that she was awarded the prize?
You know, as a reader, you love a writer. It feels like a personal love affair, and then it's hard in a way to explain. The real trick is if a writer can make many, many people feel that way. And she does. And I think part of that is that she has incredibly lucid vision of the world and an unsparing one and is very honest.
You know, my reaction instantly was, oh, my God, they awarded it based on writing instead of politics.
Right.
Every year it seems like there's sort of something politically transparent about the choice.
Well, you think to yourself, oh, will people start saying, oh, they gave it to her because she's Canadian? It seems hard to, imagine. But they do sometimes say, oh, well, they gave it to that writer because they're from,
yes,
you know, X country or Y country. It's hard to imagine. That's one of the things about Canada. Canada doesn't seek special favors and usually doesn't get them, you know. Maybe people will say she gets it because she's a woman. I doubt it. There are lots of other women out there who seem to have been more in line for that type of accolade. She's somebody who doesn't seek these things. So that's part of the thrill, too.
Readers of The New Yorker have been reading her short stories for decades now. And it was interesting at this morning's editorial meeting, somebody said, I don't even know who she is. And we all jumped on them. What is interesting is that those stories, though they may be set in Canada, they don't scream Canadiana or being Canadian. Margaret Atwood publicly has been much more sort of pro-Canadian, Canadian culture. But it seems like Alice Munro has just been sort of quietly writing.
I think that's really true. I think she isn't a critic. She isn't a spokesperson. She isn't a public figure. 20 years ago, I drove the car for my husband to interview her at home. We took a wrong turning and we asked people in the town how to get to her house. And everybody knew, but nobody was going to tell us because they knew she didn't like visitors. So, you know, they knew she didn't want people driving up in front of her house and taking a photo. So we had the devil of a time finding her because she didn't want to be found.
Even though you were invited.
Right. That was the thing. We had to persuade. We went into a shop and finally persuaded somebody that we were legit and got the directions. But the first couple of people we asked, they weren't going to tell us.
So what is Canadian about her?
That's a bigger conversation. What is Canadian? I think, you know, I have a Canadian friend and we joke that saying sorry is Canadian. Sorry. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Sorry. That's Canadian. I don't know if that really is, but I think certainly lack of affectation, lack of pretense, you know, she's not interested in glamour. She's interested in true, real things. And you can call that Canadian or not Canadian, but I think Canadians would like to think it's Canadian.
She is definitely not one to say sorry. She dives right in there into the interior life of her protagonists and the interior life of these places she writes about and nature.
Alice Munro's characters are very complicated, spiky people. They are not easily likable. They are not sort of cuddly and lovable. They're people with highly idiosyncratic psyches and strange behaviors and unpleasant longings. She's completely unafraid, and that's part of her genius.
Alice Munro came of age as a writer in the 1960s, and Margaret Atwood has described being a writer in the 1960s, a female writer, as still sort of like being a freak. What did Atwood mean by that?
I think the combination of being a woman writer and being in Canada. You know, there was a time when Canadian literature, or Ken Lit, people really thought essentially of Robertson Davies and Margaret Atwood. You know, those were the names that outside Canada people were aware of. For a Canadian, for a Canadian woman, it meant breaking certain traditions and stepping out of line.
You know, she's now 82 and she started becoming a writer or becoming known in the 1960s. And we just talked about kind of how unusual it was for a woman of that era. Does that setting and that backdrop, that emotional backdrop come through in her stories written then about being a woman and being a writer?
In some of the early stories, absolutely that sense comes across. I'm reminded, though, of a wonderful story she told when we met her, which was about the fact that she was in Vancouver with young children at the time when she was first publishing. And she said it was the 50s, you know, and we lived in the suburbs and you were supposed to have always a pot of coffee on the go. And if a neighbor came around, you were supposed to open the door to your impeccable house and have coffee ready and invite them in, you know. And she said, I was no good at that. And at one point, one of her daughters was asked at school, or the class was asked, what do your parents do? And her daughter put up her hand and said, my mummy rests. Because when she wanted to write, she would go in the bedroom and shut the door and say, Mommy's resting now. So her daughter put up her hand and said, Mommy rests.
You're a writer, and in literary circles, do you think everyone today is sort of saying, wow, what a great choice?
I'm sure there are some naysayers out there. Damn them. But but I think the vast preponderance of people are jumping up and down and are absolutely thrilled.
Clara Massoud hails from Canada as well as the U.S. Her latest novel is The Woman Upstairs. Thanks so much, Claire.
Thank you, Carol.
Canadians may have a reputation, deserved or not, to be loath to grab the spotlight, but for the past few years, Canada has been at the center of a raging international controversy. It centers on the tar sands of Alberta. There's a lot of oil up there, and Canada's been putting on a full-court press to ship it out of the country. One possible route is the proposed Keystone XL oil pipeline here in the U.S. Another is a planned pipeline on Canadian soil to the Atlantic Ocean. Supporters tout it as a nation-building project. But opponents say what's really building is nationwide opposition to new pipelines. Here's more from reporter Sam Harnett.
So they've had their first cutting. Hopefully they'll get a second one soon.
Christine McKean opens a gate to a hayfield by her house on the outskirts of Canada's capital, Ottawa. But there's more than grass poking out of the ground here.
See those two yellow stakes on the road? That indicates the pipeline.
The pipeline that crosses here was built years ago to carry natural gas from Atlantic ports west to the country's interior. But now the company TransCanada wants to put the old line to a new use. It wants to reverse its flow, add hundreds of miles of new pipeline, and convert the whole thing to carry oil from the tar sands of Alberta east for export to world markets. The project is called Energy East, and like many along the route, McKean wants no part of it. She worries about spills of the tar sands' thick, gooey oil, like the one 3 years ago in Michigan, or worse.
I mean, if there was an explosion out here, we're pretty close.
Canada's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, hopes to convince opponents like McKean. Harper's made exporting tar sands oil a cornerstone of his economic policy. He's pushed hard for the Keystone XL pipeline across the U.S., and he's casting Energy East as a nation-building project, like the Transcontinental Railroad. It was built under Canada's first prime minister, John A. Macdonald. Not everyone buys the comparison.
This is sort of, I think, disturbing John A. Macdonald's grave, if you wish.
Peter Stute teaches political science at Concordia University in Montreal. He says Quebec and Ontario are the big battlegrounds for Energy East, and he thinks the nationalist pitch could backfire.
Quebecers do not like being told that they have a specific role to play, let's say, in building a broader Canada.
Without the support of Quebec and Ontario, the project can't happen. And that's got environmentalists here mobilizing. This is dirty oil, they say. It will be a huge step backwards in the fight against climate change, not a step forward for the economy.
The reality is, this is not about meeting local needs.
Andrea Harden-Donohue is an energy and climate campaigner at the Council of Canadians.
This is actually about getting the crude to coastal waters, so ensuring that big oil and its government allies are getting the world price for crude produced in the tar sands, because right now they're not.
Well, of course, our opponents are going to say exactly that and probably other things.
That's TransCanada spokesperson Philip Cannon. He says, like the Keystone Project, the Eastern Pipeline is just about getting a vital product to market.
At the end of the day, it is the safest way to move oil around, and it's not tomorrow that we're going to stop to rely on a daily basis on oil in our life.
The benefits and costs of moving oil around by any means are increasingly sensitive issues in Canada.
Are we getting something from this? No, we're not.
Louis Longchamp comes from Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. This summer, a runaway oil train exploded here, engulfing the town in flames and killing 47 people. In Lac-Mégantic recently, bulldozers were still clearing rubble next to what had been the offices of the local newspaper. The paper's editor, Romé Tremblay, says the trains here used to carry lumber, which supported the local economy. But oil, he says, is different.
La situation à Lac-Mégantic,
Tremblay says oil transport towns like Lac-Mégantic bear all the risk with none of the rewards. Supporters say the pipeline would be a safer way to transport oil, but Tremblay thinks that's the wrong conclusion. He says Canadians should be talking instead about alternative energy and a new deal.
A new deal between industry and community.
Environmentalists agree. Andrea Harden-Donohue says Tremblay's sentiment is the true nation-building result of projects like Energy East.
The real nation building happening is the coast-to-coast resistance to tar sands pipelines. They're being blocked in the west, they're being blocked trying to move it down south, and sure enough, they will be blocked trying to move this out east.
TransCanada is undaunted. The company will seek approval early next year and hopes that the oil will flow by 2018. But if this tar sands pipeline doesn't go through, Peter Stute at Concordia University thinks the industry will keep trying until one does.
Yeah, I think it is likely that one of these projects will end up going through.
The economic incentives, he says, are just too powerful to resist. For The World, I'm Sam Harnett, Montreal.
And we stay in Canada for yet another story. This one involves pea soup, a favorite for many Canadians, and a chef from Ottawa named Marc Miron. He was inspired by celebrations this year marking the 400th anniversary of French explorer Samuel de Champlain's mapping expeditions down the Ottawa River. And that led him to explore the history of pea soup.
Basically, I thought it would be interesting to actually go back and look at what they were eating and what could have been one of their eating habits during that time in the 1600s. One of the things that it was quite surprised to me is that the famous Habitant pea soup was actually created during that time. The rich was eating a lot of meat, not so much vegetables, and the peasant was not so fortunate to have so much meat, so they had to find a way to actually create things that would be quite substantial and nourishes, and you know, so they create that soup, which is a meal by itself, basically. To add to that, they had calibrate their meat, if you want. They had some of the salted meat, that they cured meat that they brought with them from France, and they create a pea soup with some cured meat. During that time, we were also eating a lot of bread, so that's why we find now crouton with it. So that famous Habitant pea soup was created during that voyage of Champlain.
So are you offering that in your restaurant?
We do, yes, absolutely. It's a very, very popular soup. Of course, we have adapted to modern age, and we're using ham now. And to simplify the whole thing, we have a recipe that actually we do a ham stock with it. And then after that, we cook the peas and the vegetables, because as you know, the ham, the hock, won't cook at the same time as the peas. So to have a better result, you do both separately, then you combine.
And we have that recipe at PRI.org. You use the word habitant, meaning an inhabitant of French descent living in Canada, especially Quebec or Louisiana. But what food and cooking traditions did the French explorers learn from the natives who were living there?
The cooking here was quite different than what they had in France, but we have the native Indian. We had tons of berry up here. They were hunting also game and stuff like that. So it was quite different than what they were used to in France. So basically, there was a great exchange. For example, for one of the pie they made, they call it frangipane with small fruit. They brought the idea of the frangipane over here, and then they used the small fruit to put in it, and it made a beautiful dessert.
So why did you want to recreate what they ate back in the 17th century? It seems like all modern diners are looking for fresh and local and green.
Yeah, well, then you touched a point there. Chefs, basically, now they're working harder and harder to try to actually find out where the food comes from, which farmers growing that. Well, I went a little bit further, and I try to find out where the food really comes from. So it's a lot of fun to bring back those classic coq au vin or bœuf bourguignon and do them the proper way and just offer them to your customers.
So if Samuel de Champlain showed up at your restaurant today, what would you be able to offer him that would be familiar to him?
We have the coq au vin. We have the braised beef bourguignon, which is a beef that is braised with red wine. We have the soup au pois, the habitant pea soup that you can recognize. And again, a whole variety of other things from the pastries to satisfy his needs.
Chef Marc Miron speaking to us from his gourmet food shop, Cuisine and Passion, in the Canadian capital, Ottawa. I'm hungry just talking to you.
Excellent. Have a great day.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Carol.
You can see Chef Marc hard at work in his kitchen and get the recipe for habitant pea soup at PRI.org. This is The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. North Korea is rushing to build a luxury ski resort. Wait, Really? A luxury ski resort in reclusive, authoritarian, strapped-for-cash North Korea? Apparently, yes. The government of Kim Jong-un has been pouring millions of dollars into the mega project. The resort is supposed to attract foreign tourists and be a training ground for North Korean athletes. Builders are trying to have it ready for skiers by winter, but when the AP's Eric Talmadge visited just over a week ago, there was still a lot to be done.
The first thing that I noticed was two very young soldiers who really looked like they were just teenagers carrying big blocks of concrete on their back up the hill. They have hundreds, maybe even thousands of what they call soldier builders, and they were scouring the mountainside trying to put the final touches on the resort, but they still had a lot of work to do at that time.
What about the mountain itself? When you look up, do you see trails and lifts? Or is it not yet at that point?
They're planning to have 10 ski runs. They've carved out most of those ski runs already. So when you look up at the mountain, you see these long, bright brown kind of scars in the forest, which covers the rest of the mountain. And because the snow hasn't fallen yet, it's still just dirt and rocks. There are two very simple chairlifts, and they were planning to have a third one completed by the end of the year in time for the actual ski season. But that ran into some problems when the Swiss government refused to permit exports from a Swiss company. And so now the North Koreans say they'll still manage to build them themselves. In fact, the Secretary General of the North Korean Ski Association said, we can build nuclear weapons and rockets. We can build a ski lift.
Hmm. That's interesting. They may be able to build it, but I guess the question is, will anybody come?
Well, that's another good question. And one of the reasons why I personally wanted to see this, because North Korea has a population of about 24 million, and according to the head of the ski association itself, only about 5,400 people ski in that country. What they are hoping is that the resort will attract foreign skiers. They're hoping that it'll be a tourist site.
But what foreign visitors go to North Korea who might go there to ski?
Their primary target is South Korean tourists. But there is also a fairly a small but steady trickle of foreigners from around the world who even now go to North Korea. You have that kind of a exotic, eccentric sort of flavor to the appeal of North Korea. But I think the North Koreans and some tour groups are hoping to make that into more of an actual people who really like to ski would like to go to North Korea.
Eric, are you a skier?
I am an eternally advanced beginner.
Is this area a place that you would want to go skiing?
They invited me back, and I definitely hope at some point I would be able to give it a try, but we'll have to see how that goes.
That was the AP's Eric Talmadge speaking to us from Tokyo. Finally today, we turn to a rising star in the art world. She's Kenyan artist Wegechi Mutu, and she has a new exhibition opening in New York tomorrow. She lives in New York, too, but as the world's Alex Galifant reports, that simple statement is more complicated than it sounds.
Wegechi Mutu has based herself in New York since 1992, when she was a student here. And the latest and biggest exhibit of her work, called A Fantastic Journey, is a kind of check-in moment, an opportunity to survey Mutu's ongoing preoccupations over the last 20 years or so, about everything from globalization, the female body, to perceptions about Africa and more. It features a variety of works, including sketchbook drawings, large format collages, and videos. As for the title, well, The Fantastic Journey was a short-lived NBC show from 1977. It was about a family lost in a parallel universe.
The story is that they're trying to get back, but they don't know where the boundaries are for this world that they're sort of trapped in.
Wegechi Mutu knows something about that feeling, thanks to her own experience with U.S. immigration authorities.
Very complicated, very difficult, and very depressing kind of situation.
Mutu thinks she got caught in post-September 11th immigration gridlock. No longer a student, she'd been granted a visa to be here, one of the ones that recognize immigrants with special abilities. But then, and this was more than 10 years ago, it was revoked. The result? Wegechi Mutu wasn't permitted to leave the United States, at least not without giving up her immigration case. So imagine, suddenly she can't visit her family in Nairobi. She can't attend international exhibitions of her work. She's stuck.
You can go to Hawaii. Hawaii makes you feel like you're actually leaving, but it's the U.S. We went to Alaska. The experience of dealing with your immigration issues is a very solitary experience. Because I think in any country, you know, the majority of the people are born there, they're naturalized, they don't have to worry about why are you here? Well, if you don't like it, why don't you go back? Or what do you mean your family can't come or you can't go or whatever it is.
Now, through all this, Wageshi Mutu was hardly still. She's always working, making art, even creating soundscapes like this one. But her immigration experience has brought into focus ideas she'd been thinking about borders, boundaries, the idea of choosing to be in one place over another.
This notion of being a transplant, of leaving your home, self-exiling, which is different from being an asylum case or a refugee, is a huge part of my work because I knew that there was something about Nairobi and Kenya as a young woman that wasn't going to suffice. It wasn't enough.
Mutu's studio is in Brooklyn. On a bookcase, there's a huge collection of National Geographics. She grew up with the magazine. Her dad subscribed. Today, its beautiful but deeply selective views of the world, including Africa, are core material for Mutu's collages. You could say that Wageshi Mutu has also assembled, collaged her own life. Self-invention is the prerogative of the artist and the immigrant alike. But she says that's a technique that many Kenyans have adopted in the 50 short years since independence. That anniversary arrives in December. The very nature of modern Kenya has meant patching together an ad hoc sense of national identity.
The colonizers left us borders that didn't make sense. They didn't describe the nations that were previously there.
Most Americans, Mutu observes, don't have to deal with identity challenges like this. Home is the U.S., and the U.S. is the U.S., and that's that.
People tend to feel like they are in the world when they're in America and born in America. They feel like this is the world.
But for America's immigrants, myself included, home is a choice, a notion, a memory, or a posture. It can be as light as your mood or as concrete as a green card. It's all fertile territory for Wageshi Mutu, who now, after 12 years of art and immigration lawyers, is free to travel and free to stay. For The World, I'm Alex Galifant in New York.
Wageshi Mutu's exhibition, A Fantastic Journey, opens tomorrow at the Brooklyn Museum. A quick burst from the music group Tal National from Niger. We'll be talking to them later this month. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. By the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.